Welcome to episode 2 of Confessions of a Cyber Psychologist. Today we are chatting to Linda Kay, Dr. Linda Kay, who is Associate Head of Psychology at Edge Hill University. And Dr. Linda Kay will be talking about later, who is one of the founding members of the British Psychology Society Cyber Psychology section, and also the keynote speaker at the 2024 Cyber Psychology Conference, which we'll also be touching on. Welcome, Dr. Linda Kay, to Confessions of a Cyber Psychologist. We're delighted to have you on board.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. I'm really looking forward to having a bit of a chat.
Excellent. It's always a delight chatting to you. So, Linda, I just want to get a bit of background from you in terms of where you've come from and what that pivot point for you was in terms of this your passion for cyber psychology. So,
I mean, like a lot of people, I did an undergraduate psychology degree, which was just a normal sort of standard BSc route. And I actually kind of fell into cyber psychology, really. It was when I started my PhD, which was just on the topic of sort of the psychological experiences of video games, broadly. And it was from trying to find conferences to go to that I then saw this term cyber psychology and thought, oh, that sounds exciting, and realised there was actually a community that my research fit into, because I think a lot of people who do cyber psychology research tend to find that at the university they might be studying it, that they might be the one of the only people in their department who might be studying it and feel a little bit isolated. And so it's nice to kind of have a collection of people who were doing things that, you know, were similar to me, or at least in the same sort of field to me. So yeah, it was very much falling into it. So the pivot for me was just finding my people, which is always nice, and recognizing that there was a broader kind of field to what I was doing.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like finding your tribe, people who you can connect with on that deep level of passion.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's always lovely about the cyber psychology community, is that it genuinely is a really supportive, frankly, community. And we certainly experience that at our own conferences in the cyber psychology section, and we get a lot of really positive feedback on that. So it's really, really lovely to have a great community.
Yeah, and especially because they throughout the UK, to come together at something like a conference is an amazing thing.
So. Yeah, I mean, for me, it's like the thing to look forward to every year is the conference. And certainly I know that it's useful for me kind of making sure I get stuff done, so I've got stuff I can present, so it's good to keep me on sort of time track, so I've got something exciting, that something new that is ready to share, so that's always good in terms of kind of managing projects and things with people from that perspective.
Exactly. And in terms of the cyber psychology community, you were instrumental or part of the founding members of the British Psychology Society cyber psychology section. That's a lot to say in a mouthful, but
yeah, we need an acronym, a better acronym, I think, than meeting people. Yeah.
So tell me about that. How did it start, kind of getting to the point where you've actually launched this whole section? And that was in 2018, I think it was recognized and officially became a section.
That's right. Yeah, so yeah, 2018 was it official kind of birth, so to speak, as a section in the BPS. Myself, and it was Dr. Anderson Atchell-Smith, and Dr. Chris Forward, and Dr. Simon Bignell, who were the sort of four founding members, really, who sort of took this forward alongside a few other people who are part of a wider sort of steering group. And it came about as part of a roundtable discussion at one of the kind of previous conference series that a lot of us used to go to. University of Wolverhampton used to do a lot of conferences and host a lot in their network there. So it was part of a roundtable discussion, and there was this general appreciation that it would be a useful thing to do. There were enough of us, enough interest, and why not have it recognised more officially as a sort of discipline of psychology? So it's that really that stimulated the movement of that. And then it involved a whole load of putting together proposals to the BPS and going to their research board and defending the proposal. And it got a lot of sort of support from BPS. We didn't come under much opposition, which was great, because we've got a lot of effort and time into the proposal. Yeah. And then it just evolved the official processes of BPS, like member approvals and voting and all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, that was several years in the making. So, it's really fantastic to see that it is now recognised and that the community just continues to be used and to grow.
And grow.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, so you keynote speaker of this year's 2024 Cyber Psychology Conference. So tell us about that and what's kind of generally, because it's the title you've got is What Cyber Psychology Can Tell About Us About the Digitally Connected Human Experience. It sounds really exciting and fascinating.
Oh, I hope it is. We'll try on the next. So I was really grateful to be invited actually to keynote. It was a lovely surprise to get in my inbox. The kind of idea was, I keep sort of using this term, digitally connected human experience, and I think there's something really intriguing about that as a term. And I kind of think, you know, it helps us recognize that as psychologists, the human experience is a kind of essence really of what we're interested in. Yeah. And actually, what does that look like? How is it different? What are the kind of nuances of it when we are in a digitally connected world? So it's trying to sort of do a bit more of a kind of bird's eye view, I guess, or cyber psychology as a whole. I am intending to draw on very specific kind of insights from my own research. So, you know, it's always just nice to be able to do, and, you know, I want to be able to talk about something I actually know about, which is good. I thought it's a keynote, a nice opportunity to kind of do that kind of sweep, I guess, and where are we up to, and where do we want to go, and what are the kind of interesting things we could get even more curious about, what do we need to discover more. So it's sort of a bit of a kind of a checkpoint really for me as well. I just find doing things like keynotes a great way of helping me consolidate my own thinking of what my thoughts are, and that, so it's useful for that as well.
Absolutely. And when is the conference?
So the conference is taking place on the 1st and 2nd of July 2024. It's great for me this year because it's really local. It's Liverpool. It's been hosted at Liverpool John Moores University. But we do have people all over, you know, the country who come and attend it, and also some international colleagues as well. The abstract deadline is actually still open. It's open until the 5th of April. I've just seen on the websites that actually there is an extended deadline as well to talk to Maple. So if you've not quite got anything ready, you've got a little bit of grace period there. and then registration will be open thereafter.
Okay. So if someone wants to come along, do they have to be a cyber psychologist, or can there be anyone who's just kind of fascinated and wants to know more? And if they do, how long do they have before they need to, or the final registration ends?
I think it's nice that, you know, anybody who's enthusiastic about cyber psychology can come. Anybody who isn't necessarily wanting to present anything, you know, the registration is open to not just to members of cyber psychology section, but much more broadly. So the deadline for registration is the 17th of June. So there's plenty of time to sort of be pondering whether you want to come along. In terms of if you wanted to present at it, then submissions for abstracts do go through a review process, and it has to sort of meet particular kind of criteria. So that will depend on that outcome of that review process. But essentially, anybody can register and attend who might just have an interest. We have had the members of the press come along to conferences before because they've seen something that has piqued their interest.
Yeah, fascinating. So in terms of what you've done to kind of promote and talk more about cyber psychology in general, you've done a TED Talk. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was a lot ago now. That was in 2017, I think.
Yeah.
That was a very rambling email to get. So it's like, email to it actually went to my junk folder, so I actually missed it for ages. So the big job I had to do is get to check my junk folder. But it wasn't junk, it was genuine. That was the TEDx Vienna, which was lovely because I went to the sports bar and theatre, which is a beautiful venue, and that was all about the what are emoji, and I can't even remember the title. What do our emoji say about you? Anything with the title?
Yeah.
Yes, it is. What can you tell about people's personality from their emojis? And that was a really good experience. It was really exciting, and something else I do, which is really nice, that I get is. You have a general theme of the conference, but everybody's from very different disciplines, but you do become a bit like a family because you spend a few days with people, and it's really nice, again, as another opportunity to talk about your ideas and research to wider audiences and people who might not necessarily know about cyber psychology. So it's great.
Have you done any more research on emojis, or is that...
I've been doing a lot of research on emoji, and actually the sort of focus of that has changed actually a little bit and evolved over time. So the previous work and the work that I presented at TEDx was based on our research more about the sort of personality judgment angle on that, so what can tell about people when we're in a social kind of interactional context. And the more recent research and a lot of the program research that got kind of mapped out now is more about how we process emoji. And so it's a bit more kind of what the cognitive processes are when we're kind of on the emotion recognition of them, and how do we kind of, what's the sort of sensory and visual and those kind of processes. So it's a lot more cognitive. But it's really interesting. I'm delving into areas of the literature and different disciplines that I haven't done for a long time. So it's really nice to continue to learn and apply really interesting approaches and experiments or paradigms and things to study this. And it's really intriguing to me that nobody's really done the kind of things I'm thinking about, which seems a bit weird because we think quite obvious things. unless I missed something. It's an exciting area to be in. And what's really good is to, because it's a lot of lab-based studies, I can get students who are interested in science psychology involved, and they can work as paid research interns and actually learn about psychology and then support with collecting data and meeting participants. And so it's useful for both of us, myself and my students.
Yeah, I think that's the great thing about cyber psychology is there's so many areas that haven't been studied and haven't been researched. So to find something that you're passionate about and not find anyone who's done it before is actually relatively easy compared to the general psychology fields. And so for you studying emojis, it might just be that there just hasn't been enough people who are fascinated by it like you are.
Possibly. And I think the other thing is that, again, I think I'm kind of going to be reflecting a bit on this in my keynote talk, is that I think sometimes there's a lot of really useful theoretical and also areas of literature that exist that actually apply really closely to some of the things we're interested in cyber psychology, but actually I don't think we're drawing on perhaps as much as we should do. So one of the particular limitations, I think, actually generally, this is not sort of specific to specific researchers, but as a general observation, is I think we tend to sort of try and start things from scratch and think, oh yeah, we need a theory to explain this. Yeah. And so the theoretical foundations of a lot of cyber psychology is a bit weak and a bit shaky. Mm. But actually, there's so many really useful frameworks in other related disciplines, sometimes even in other areas of psychology that actually apply. Well, I think they apply really well. So if we use those, we've got a much stronger foundation. So I think that's the general observation. And so I think it's the case that people who think of the kind of cyber psychology angle and have got these ideas, but just haven't kind of made the connection with what kind of currently exists in other areas. Maybe that might be why there's areas that haven't quite fully been explored yet.
Yeah, absolutely. Just going back to your research, so in terms of your TEDx talk, it sounds to me as though the research you did before was how people use emojis to express themselves, and now it's about how people receive those emojis and how that then resonates with them psychologically and cognitively. So is that fair to say?
Yes, yeah, I think it's sort of shifted from what the interpretations are about it in a social context, yes, and to more from a receiver's point of view, how it actually is processed, not sort of in a communication context, but on a very kind of on that kind of an automatic level. So looking at, you know, is it a kind of implicit judgment process or is it more explicit? So using different kind of measures to answer that question.
Yeah. So, and just kind of taking your research out of the academic realm, how do you think people who are not academics will be able to use your research and your findings in a way that will benefit them? Do you think it's for teachers, therapists, parents? Who do you think is going to really benefit most from what you're finding out?
Yeah, well, different ways, actually. I mean, I'm currently working with an organisation called Theoremitics, and they're based over in the US, and they actually cooperate with somebody there. And they actually are interested in the research, and actually we collaborated and published together because they use the insights on that to understand how we can use emoji, or how different businesses can use emoji to understand net emotion index and sentiment of remote working and sort of well-being and the well-being metric of organisations. So actually being used in a sort of organisational sort of context, which is something I would never really thought about. So again, it's useful that people kind of approach you and kind of say, I've got this particular thing and I think this could be relevant. Think, oh, glad you made that connection because I haven't. So in that context, I think, and I can see a lot of scope there. I think in terms of things like digital marketing as well, so some of this sort of currently planning is looking at things to do with, do we experience the idea of what we might call approach and withdrawal. And so do we actually experience those sorts of, I think that'd be, so something else I'm sort of interested in at the moment is looking at how we might experience emoji in terms of, do we feel that we approach or withdraw? So that, again, there's interesting frameworks in psychology about that idea of approach and withdraw, and from a kind of emotion point of view. We're more drawn to positive emotion, more likely to inhibit a negative. So I'm kind of interested in that. So I think digital, from a digital marketing perspective, what's interesting is how that might relate to brand perception and engagement. Yeah, that kind of thing. That's what I'm kind of thinking. So, I think it can be kind of applied to those sorts of contexts as well.
So that's fascinating. So it's almost narrative psychology, but from an emoji perspective.
I don't know what narrative psychology is.
So it's about the words we use to describe what we're going through and using different words that mean different things, and how that then really gives a good indication of where we're at.
Yes, I guess that's quite a nice summary, actually. Yeah, and I think what's interesting about emoji, what we have to be careful of, is you tend to have this assumption that emoji are a universal language. And I would tend to disagree with that, because we don't seem to, on one hand, we don't seem to process emotionally on a kind of implicit level. So I think there is a kind of evaluation process that goes on. And what the implication of that is that we have different interpretations of the same emoji. So that we have diverse ways that we label them and use them in different contexts. So from a kind of narrative psychology point of view, I think it's interesting that we don't all share a narrative. There are differences. So I think that's sort of a really important caveat of this kind of emoji research.
Is there a difference between generations from the perspective that I'm assuming that older generations don't use emojis as much as the younger generations to express themselves? And there's a, in some ways, almost like, let me stop it again. So from a generational perspective, do you think that there's a difference because older generations won't, I suspect, use emojis as much as younger generations, and there's meaning attached to specific emojis that some people will understand and others won't? Is there this generation difference, or is it more about a culture, a group context of what they talk about and how they speak?
Yeah, I think it's a mixture of things. I don't think there's a clear generational kind of distinction. I think you sometimes see a bit of soul kind of trends, but definitely it's sort of I think it's less about how much people use them, but the way they use them is maybe different. And again, we see that when we look at sort of gender differences. Again, it's not the case that females use more emoji than men. It's not that they're more likely to use them for emotional expression than men, and men are more likely to use them for other like punctuation or all that kind of stuff. So I think it's that there are distinctions, not necessarily always very clear cut, but we do see trends about and being used in maybe different ways. And I think we also have to remember now the software is developed where we can have emoji as reactions to messages. And again, that's a sort of different way that we might use them. Younger generations might be more likely to make more use of those as a substitute to written comments and things like that. So I think there's kind of nuances on that. Never a clear answer, is there? I didn't give a yes or no to your question. It was no. Depends.
Yeah, that's generally the answer in psychology. It depends.
It always depends.
There's caveats. Because that's interesting, though, that there's now those reactions to a message, because it kind of tells someone that you've read it and you acknowledge it, but actually you don't have to go to the effort of replying and thinking through what the answer ought to be without offending or saying the wrong thing.
Yeah, it's really interesting. There's actually a really kind of interesting sort of popular book called, Netiquette. And it talks about what does a like actually mean and the different interpretations of that. And I think that's the same for things like reactions, is that sometimes it might just be an acknowledgement, sometimes it might be, and that could in some cases just be very abrupt and could be interpreted as being a bit rude. In other sides, it might just be, yeah, I've just not had time to play it, I'm just saying, I've seen it, I love it. So yeah, I think there's, again, it's that, you know, is it really universal when we have all these different contexts that affect how we make a judgment about what that means, and also that people interpret things differently anyway. So.
Yeah. And that, even that's fascinating, because even from my perspective, when I react to a text, I think people think the same as me with my reaction.
Yeah.
And they possibly don't, and going, that's rude, rather than, oh, she's seen it.
Yeah, I've had this conversation before with somebody. I think there's I'm not sure if it's being done or not, but, you know, I think there's a really interesting theory of mind kind of piece there about how do you use emoji based on what your understanding of another person's appraisal is about how you're using it. So, and then there's a multi sort of interaction that happens there. And certainly, I know there is research that looks at the kind of mirroring of emoji. And you know, just anecdotally, I had to do that myself. People who don't use them much, I don't use them much with. If I know somebody uses this kind of emoji a lot, I might be more likely to use it. So there's a really interesting interactional kind of thing that goes on there. But yeah, definitely there's something interesting about how we use them and interpret them based on our own kind of construct on what things mean.
Well, that's just, this is why I love cyber psychology. It's so many fascinating things you don't think about, and suddenly you go, oh.
No, and actually, this is a really nice example of why I really like doing these kind of things, because I often am thinking out loud, and I think, you know, verbalize things that either have been kind of pondering in there, or things that I hadn't thought about before, and it's just prompted you to think that it's really useful.
Yay! Brilliant. And now, during lockdown, I know that you did wrote a book. You may or may not be able to see this, but I'll put a link to it in the chat. Issues and debates in cyber psychology. So what started this whole process of writing this book on your own and getting it published?
Well, first I was invited to write it, so that's always good. And it came actually at a really good time. Well, two reasons for the time being. Actually, in retrospect, it was very useful. One is that I think I was at a point where I was thinking about a lot of different things in kind of isolation of each other. I didn't have that opportunity to kind of bring them together. And as I was sort of saying earlier, again, a good value for me for doing things like keynote talks is that it helps me do that bird's eye view things. And so actually really useful. It was at a point where I thought I really need to piece these things together in my head. And actually for me, writing things really helps me do that. And I did find I think through things better when I write things out.
Yeah.
So it seemed like a really good point in time to do it. And from a kind of career perspective, and I had a chat with a few colleagues, senior colleagues, and they said, yeah, I think it's a good point in your career to be a named author on a book. This, you know, it can be helpful. Because I don't know how familiar you are with working in academia, but certainly psychology sort of research papers rather than books tend to be kind of rated, the kind of esteem in higher esteem books. But yeah, it seemed like a good thing to do because of that. And as well as that, kind of looking back retrospectively, it's just coincidence that it fell aligned with the time where we were experiencing a lot of lockdowns. And honestly, I think it was probably one of my saving graces. I think a lot of people obviously experience a lot of, you know, isolation and, you know, all that kind of thing. But it was a channel for me to just kind of get, you know, and articulate things. So I think kind of looking back, it was kind of good that it happened during that time as well.
Yeah. It's a fascinating book. And I just thoroughly enjoyed reading. I was like, oh, yes. I didn't know that. Oh, that's amazing. So who do you think is the right, or the people who would be really interested in this book and go, yeah, you really need to read this? Is it people who are starting off in the undergrad, or is it just a general knowledge book? What do you think is a good type of person to pick it up?
Yeah,
and everyone.
I mean, I think it applies quite well to lots of different audiences. I think certainly it's one of the key texts on one of the modules I do on cyber psychology, and I've actually now situated the module so it is more aligned to the kind of themes of the book, so it speaks a bit more directly. So that's also helpful for me and my teaching to kind of just review that. But actually, I think my main reason for doing it was actually probably more targeted towards media commentators, journalists, because often, a lot of people who work in cyber psychology, myself included, get a lot of requests for comments on, things that relate to popular debates.
Yeah.
And that things like screen time or social media wellbeing, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So actually having a book that situates the evidence around those sort of debates, I thought was a helpful way of framing it, rather than just there's a book on this and it's let's weigh up this and come to some kind of informed conclusion. So I think from that perspective, that in my head, I start thinking about future Linda, and this might rectify and give people the kind of answers that it might be useful. I think students, but also general public, is accessible enough for public audiences as well.
Yeah, I think it's accessible enough for public audiences. It does. It's kind of quite an academic style of writing, but that's because you are an academic, so it's kind of naturally. But it is. I think what's really great about it is it's very readable and very consumable by someone who doesn't have a background in academics or cyber psychology. So it is. It's not a long book, mean that in the nicest possible way.
I don't think I could have written any more. So. I thought actually when I pencil on physical copy, I thought that's quite nice actually. It's just a little
digestible.
It works out quite well.
Yeah, it's something that's easily read within a week, over a few cups of coffee,
and that's eaten it.
And just still so rich with information. And just talking about journalists, because you said a lot of journalists contact academia. Do you find that often journalists or the mass media misrepresents the information that academics do find and do write about in the papers that they publish? Or do you think they generally are getting it sort of okay right?
Things seem to be improving, I'd say. Sorry, it's another it depends answer.
Yeah.
I work with some very, very good journalists who used to take a lot of time to speak with experts who do their own research, who do a really good job of representing the kind of where the science is at. I'm not saying that's always the case. It does, to some extent, depend on the particular news outlet they're representing. Not to name anyone in particular. I don't engage with because I don't agree with the way that they do journalism. But certainly people I've worked with have done a really good job at being able to represent. And I think it's often the kind of default mode is let's kind of panic a bit about these kind of things. But actually I have seen improvements to be honest, what can be represented in the media can only be based on the quality of the science that exists. And I think part of the ongoing challenge we have in cyber psychology, and I know there are lots of other scholars who experience this as well, is that we're constantly battling against ourselves, where we have very different sort of philosophical views about technology. And when there's so much contrasting opinion perspective in the discipline itself, that really doesn't help journals try and understand where you've got these sort of very different views. Where do you find the kind of synergy of that and the kind of the agreed consensus points? Because there are very many. So I actually don't blame journalists, to be honest, because it's a bit of a mismatch of evidence. So I think there's a learning point there about what the discipline itself can do to support itself and be represented better. But there are a lot of tremendous efforts from good groups of research groups of people who are really trying to rectify that. And I know, colleagues are involved in a kind of a really high level government level of informing policy, and that it is the right people who are doing the good science. So that's always really encouraging, and that kind of reassures me a bit.
Yeah, that is encouraging for me too, because I often talk to cyber psychologists who are so frustrated at what's coming out of in the mass media, the clickbaits, and the it's all about getting, or it seems to be all about getting eyeball attention, rather than decent science. So it's so refreshing, so good to hear that that work's being done by great academics, and there are a lot of, or there are quite a lot of good academics, really great academics in cyber psychology.
They also do a lot of work on the kind of public facing stuff. So one comes to mind is the Oxford Internet Institute, and they I actually saw the other day they were actually advertising for somebody to do the kind of public law sort of media kind of facing stuff. So they're investing a lot of resource in understanding why it's important to be disseminating the research and making it available in a format that's accessible. So that's really good to see the kind of investment there.
That's amazing. Really, really good news. So you are researching emojis.
Yeah.
What else are you researching? Is there anything else that you find really fascinating that you're diving into?
A few other bits and bobs. I think my problem has always been I'm a bit of a magpie. I just think, oh, that's exciting, I'll do that, and end up being way too broad. Emoji stuff is always kind of very central and where the kind of very sort of rigorous academic stuff comes in. But I'm also interested in understanding social media behaviours a bit more. Collaborate colleagues at Aston University on this. And we talk about social media use, and that isn't, I don't really know what that means. That can mean a lot of things. People thought, well, you know, we can then talk about active use and passive use, and that still
doesn't quite help me understand what that is.
So, yeah, looking more intricately at what the nature of different specific behaviours are that underpin use, it's really interesting to me. And I'd love to do more research to look at how that's specific types of behaviours change over time and context. So doing some military sort of assessments that looks at the mood drivers or the context drivers about why you might do certain types of behaviour at different points in the day or whatever. I think there's something interesting there. I try to kind of scrutinise that a bit more and understand that, because essentially as a psychologist, I'm interested in behaviour and I want to let you understand what those behaviours are and what might be psychologically interesting there. So.
Yeah,
so that doing stuff on that as well. Other things that kind of more industry sort of kind of work, collaborating in the very end stage of getting proposals together on thinking about drivers of technology acceptance in industry, so how we can support technology diffusion and implementation. So again, drawing on what we know from sort of technology integration models and that the technology acceptance literature there. I think there's some interesting work there to do as well, but that's in very, very early stages.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've also spoken about students who can get involved with your research. So tell me more about that. If someone wants to know more about cyber psychology or get an undergrad with some experience in that, what kind of things do you get students involved with that will give them that experience?
Yes, so at HL in the Department of Psychology where I work, we have a really great paid research internship scheme. So that's where our second year students and those who are on our master's conversion course can apply to be basically a research assistant in the department to work with colleagues on live projects. So over many years, and we'll continue to be doing this, as always the funding is available to do it, which is looking like it might be next year, which is great. Is to just advertise projects on psychology and logy, and then I've always been able to engage students on those projects, and they do a lot of really useful work to support my research, but also they learn about like cyber psychology and psychology, how to do psychology research, and by practically doing it, which is obviously useful from a learning perspective.
Yeah,
and so they can get involved in and actually the research itself in that way, and as a result, they then, if we publish those papers, they again become co-authors because it's a valid contribution to the research, which is great for them as well. And as well as that, second year actually we have a final year optional module, which is what I wrote in cyber psychology. It's a really cool module and obviously very biased, but I was getting loads of positive feedback from it. Students seem to really enjoy the module and just helps them have varied discussions and answer questions that they're interested in and think about the applied nature of it and how we can translate into all sorts of different contexts. So those are the ways I can get HDL that people can get involved in cyber psychology.
So if a parent is watching this or one of the children and they're really fascinated with psychology and want to get involved in cyber psychology at some point, I think this is an area that they may be really interested in the future. How do they register for an undergrad and what kind of processes would they need to go through? Because it's the academic year is still about 6 months away. So what are the processes? Is it too late to apply or do they need to still do other stuff?
Usually undergraduate recruitment setting at HDL, it might be different. All the universities go through the UCAS system, so it is too late for this coming academic year. Right. So normally the UCAS deadline is usually end of January,
right.
Sometime in January. So it will be too late for this coming academic year, but for September 2025 entry, and we're already into that 25 entry, you have the specs and things. So it's not too far in advance for me to be thinking about that. It would be a case of the application window would be opening September to January coming year. So that would be the time to be looking at options and applying.
Is there anything else that you want to kind of chat about or that we haven't covered that you find completely fascinating about cyber psychology or someone who hasn't or really interested in cyber psychology or has no experience or understanding of it? Are there any things that you think actually they really need to know this?
I think what's useful is that there's a lot of really useful kind of accessible resources out there. And it's something I did alongside my book where some what I call cyber bite sort of videos, which sort of summarized the video summaries of each chapter. And I actually found that really useful actually on my cyber psychology module as well to kind of give a kind of little bit of a trailer and the particular issues. So it kind of works quite nicely in the companion resource to the book, but also those can be watched and accessed just in isolation as well. So and there's other kind of examples of resources about topics in cyber psychology. You've got the pieces for the conversation that colleagues have written on topics related to that. Those are really good. They're designed specifically for public audiences. That kind of digest some of the issues and give an accessible summary of the kind of scientific evidence. And I think things like that, there's lots of examples of those that exist. And there are some, as far as I'm aware, still some resources on BPS Cyber Psychology section website as well. So, and on there, actually, what's really good is the BPS have actually been doing a series of careers in cyber psychology, which I know you'll know about because you've done one for us, which is amazing. And then the really, really useful to give insights into how cyber psychology is applied in different types of careers. And again, I think you're a really good example of that. It's the kind of thing I wouldn't, again, naturally think about where cyber psychology fits, but obviously does really well. So those are really good as well, the careers in cyber psychology series that our colleague, our local meeting, John Bly, have done a fantastic job at.
Yes. So, and one final question, what is your favourite cyber psychology book?
There are a lot of really good resources out there. I think one of my favourite ones is possibly the Introduction to Cyber Psychology resource that was published and edited by colleagues at IAPT over in Dunleary. They just released the second edition, or it's on my bookshelf, which I have.
Yes, get it.
And it's actually this one that a BPF's core textbook series as well, which is even better. But this one's great. This is really comprehensive, and I find it useful. Again, to recommend to students, it's very sort of accessible in terms of it breaks down a lot of this sort of very technical content areas inside the psychology. So, which I would always say that one. So, that was a really good one, and I do have a lot of. Fondness of that as well, because I was invited to write a foreword for that one, and I originally launched the book on its first edition over in Ireland, so that was always really nice. So, the colleagues over there are really nothing friendly, and so that was a good one.
And in terms of that book, how is it different to the first edition? Is it, are there new topics, or is it just updated research?
It's a bit of a mixture. So it's in broadly just sort of updates. And there are a couple of new topics in there. Can't remember now off the top of my head what they are, but there definitely were some new sections in it. But yes, there was a progression on the first one in terms of it has been updated. Because obviously, that being on the nature of cyber psychology, is, you know, the research moves quite fast. So these things do need to be updated quite regularly. So,
excellent. Because I've bought the first one. So I'm like, yes, I do need to buy the second one.
Possibly. I'll double check which the topics are.
I think I need to anyway, because it's just always fascinating to get updated research. Because as you say, it moves on so quickly. And there's always new technology coming up, and so therefore new behaviors that we display, and us, the way that we engage with technology changes over time as well, and our cultural shift changes. So you really do need to keep up to date with cyber psychology information. It's not just, you know, it therefore done slightly different things like child development, for example, because there's new research, but it's not as fast paced, which is the exciting things about cyber psychology.
This is interesting, and this is exciting. Sometimes I just think, you know, I need about 5 minutes to be able to study all the things I'm interested in and keep up to the pace, which again is part of the problem, I think, of being quite broad in the kind of things I'm interested in, because then it's very difficult to keep track of all the different advancements in this, like, even though they're still all within the same field, that it's quite a task to do. So again, that's a lesson to me to be a bit more focused.
Brilliant. Linda, it's been a delight and a joy chatting to you, as it always is. And all the best with your preparation for the Cyber Psychology Conference. And I look forward to seeing you again soon.
Yeah, thank you.
And thank you for joining us at episode 2 of Confessions of a Cyber Psychologist.